And I'm David Hill. I'm president of the Schwieg Island Historical Society, and I welcome you to the second of our autumn-winter lecture series. Or is it the third? Third. The continuation of our meetings presented online in a virtual setting. Next year, we hope to be back to meeting in person, but in the meantime, we appreciate the opportunity to reach out to people who might not otherwise be able to attend these meetings on the island in person. Tonight, we welcome our friend Earl Shuttleworth to tell us about Portland architecture in the 1700s and 1800s, roughly. Earl will be happy to field questions at the end of the discussion. So there will be a time at that point to raise your hand, use the icon on the bottom center of your screen, and have a discussion about what Earl has presented. And I will recognize you and take you off mute so you'll be able to speak. And I'll try to take questions in the order in which they come. Now, Donna, are you ready to list the lectures that are coming up?
Yes, the next one is me. I'm a lecturer. It's going to be the Schwieg history up to the 20th century.
And beyond that?
No, we only have an hour.
No. Not beyond the 20th century, but the next presentation, if you have that.
I don't have that. I have to go back in again, but that will get people. Oh, it's Earl.
Yes.
This is the Donna and Earl show. Earl is going to talk about the fire in March, the big Portland fire in 1866, which, you know, changed Portland. It changed the direction it was going in and changed the, it really, I'm not going to tell you about it. He knows.
All right.
So that's what it is so far. Although I may get bumped by somebody else. I'm working on another lecturer who would be a lot better than me, but
I don't know about that.
That's the end of that one.
So if we were in the Island Hall, there would be a donation bucket by the door. And tonight we don't have a door, much less a bucket. We do have our website, www.schwieghistory.com, where you can find all sorts of Schwieg-related gift items and or make a donation to help your museum carry on, and where you can also find updates on the current lectures that are coming up, and both audio and visual, depending on the lecture, of past lectures that we've done over the summer and into the fall. So be sure to visit our website for the unique Schwieg Island gifts and watch for when we'll be open in person very soon, I hope. And I'd like to thank everybody who's donated to the Historical Society this year, and thank you for your support during these strange times. Four people entered the room. I'm going to break at the moment and let them in. Kind of serving double duty here. Here we go. All right. So now I'd like to introduce Earl Shuttleworth, an old friend of ours, old in periods of knowing each other, certainly chronologically.
There you go.
Yeah, I have to be careful when you say that. But Earl attended Deering High School, Colby College, and Boston University, and was the recipient of honorary degrees from Bowdoin College and the Maine College of Art. He became the architectural historian for the Maine Historic Preservation Commission in 1973 and director of that organization in 1976.
Remember, I gave you the meeting ID?
Yeah, here.
He retired in 2015.
What? I want it on my screen.
Okay, I'm going to mute.
No, I can't do it on your iPad.
Oh,
I can't. Okay, I can't. I'd like to do it on my.
Let me mute that person. Okay. it's a new medium that we're working in here, and we're all learning new things as we go. So Earl has lectured and written extensively on Maine history and architecture and has served as state historian since 2004. And it's with great pleasure and appreciation that we welcome Earl to the screen tonight. And I will pass the baton over to Earl.
Go
Go right ahead. And I will start to bring up the slides.
The first image, yes.
First image. Okay, what happened to it? For goodness sake, it was here a second ago. If I do this, and then I do.
Good. And then you go to.
First slide. There we go.
Yep.
That should do it.
There. Great, David. Thank you. Are we all set, David?
Yes, we are. Go right ahead.
Okay, thank you. Well, once again, it's a pleasure to be with you this evening. I really enjoyed our getting together a couple months ago when we covered the colonial period of the development of Portland through its architecture, primarily the 17th and 18th centuries. And now we're going to pick up on that story and do a little bit of transition in the 17th and 18th century, but then go right into the 19th century up to the period of the fire and shortly thereafter. We're looking here at a hypothetical map done in the late 19th century of what Falmouth Neck, now Portland, would have been like in 1690. We see why it was called the Neck, because actually the peninsula went right out into the bay, and there was that narrow strip of land between what would be 4th Street and what was roughly in today's location, Oxford Streets. And then to the left would be where the Western Promenade is now, and to the right would be Munjoy Hill. This was the configuration of what is modern day Portland in the 17th, 18th, and into the early 19th centuries. Settlement occurred on the peninsula as early as 1632. The initial settlement was wiped out twice in the French and Indian Wars in the late 17th century. And so it wasn't until just about 300 years ago that people began to return to the area and began to build more substantial homes with the assurance that there was a certain amount of stability and safety that hadn't occurred during the 17th and early 18th centuries. Next, please.
Oh, come on.
There we go. As we mentioned in our last talk, there are no pre-revolutionary houses on the Portland Peninsula because of the fact that there were two more destructions, 1775 by the British, and then the Great Fire that, as Donna has mentioned, I'll be getting into in the March lecture. So the place that we look for the 18th century houses within the confines of modern Portland today is in Stroudwater. Stroudwater was a village within the confines of Falmouth, and fortunately it was not destroyed in the destructions that occurred to the peninsula, and as a result there are some very early houses there. This is a little 1.5-story cape style house, typical of the houses that would have been built from the 1720s to the time of the Revolution for people of more modest means. This is the David Patrick House, built about 1743 in Stroudwater. Next, please. And of course, one of the great houses surviving in Stroudwater from the 18th century is the George Tate House. George Tate came from London in 1750 as an agent to procure the wonderful stands of masts that were particularly in Gorham and Wyndham that were cut for the King's Navy for the construction of Royal Naval vessels in England, shipped over there on special mast ships. And in 1755, George Tate made his residence permanent in Stroudwater by building this very substantial house with a very distinctive gambrel roof. As you'll note, it doesn't have a peaked roof, but rather the fashion of the roof extends out in a couple breaks of angle. It is very simple on the exterior, with the exception of the lovely Georgian doorway with the pilasters on either side and the triangular pediment above. Next, please. But when we go inside, we find that there is a very elegant Georgian style interior, starting with what is a very small entrance hall, because there's that large central chimney that really provides fireplaces for the house on both the first and second stories. So the staircase has to wind its way up in front of that central chimney. But as you can see, very elegant woodwork with the varying styles of balusters in the staircase. Next, please. And then in the rooms themselves, very fine Georgian style woodwork. This is the principal mm-hmm. parlor, which you would enter if you went to the right. And you'll see the pilasters on either side above the fireplace is a couple examples of raised paneling. There's more raised paneling on either side. This whole fireplace wall is done in Georgian paneling. Next, please. Now we return back to what is today the Portland Peninsula, and we're looking at a very remarkable document. This is the DeBar survey chart of 1776. The DeBar charts were made of the entire Atlantic coast for the British Navy to use during the Revolution. And this is the one which covers both Falmouth Neck and Casco Bay, and we're really zeroing in just on the neck. As we saw in the 17th century map a few moments ago, the neck is still very pronounced. Later on in the 19th century, there'll be quite a bit of landfill in Back Cove that will enlarge the peninsula of Portland, but for now, it's still very much the neck. And what we find in this 1776 map in red are the street patterns of the town of Falmouth on the neck. And basically that village area was 4th Street to the south, Congress Street to the north, and then we would have Washington Avenue to the east, and Center Street to the west. And so as a result, it was a very compact area that was settled on the neck all through the 17th and 18th century up until after the Revolution. Next, please. In October of 1775, the British naval captain, Captain Henry Mowat, brought a small fleet up from Boston to punish the rebellious citizens of Falmouth. He gave them a short warning of a day or so to leave their homes, and then he commenced to bombard the town on the neck that we just saw, that red area. That was devastating. There were about 500 houses and buildings on the neck at that time, and of them, about 400 were destroyed. And in the years immediately after that destruction, from about 1775 into the mid 1780s, very few people lived on the neck, on the peninsula. They were concerned about the British returning. Many of them actually migrated to Gorham and to Falmouth and to Scarborough and surrounding towns. But when the Revolution ended and the peace treaty was signed in 1783, people began to come back and rebuild the community on the peninsula. And here we see one of the first houses to be built in the post-revolutionary period. It is what we today know as the Wadsworth Longfellow House, or Longfellow's House on Congress Street. Originally, its configuration was two and a half stories, entirely of brick. It was the first entirely brick house to be built on the peninsula. And it was built by the poet's grandfather, General Peleg Wadsworth, who had served in the Revolution. He had been involved in the attempt to take back Castine for the British in 1779, was briefly held as a prisoner by the British, and then escaped and worked his way back to the Portland area. To the right, in the 1780s, he built a general store where the entrance to the Maine Historical Society is now off Congress Street. And so from 1786, when this house was completed, until 1807, General Wadsworth lived there. And then in 1807, 1808, he moved to Wadsworth Hall in Hiram, up what was the wilds of Western Maine at the time, because he had received a large amount of land as a bounty for serving as in the Revolution. And he built a great house there, which he lived in until his death in 1829. And that house, Wadsworth Hall in Hiram, is still in the Wadsworth family to this day. So what happened with this, with the brick house that was before us, is that in 1805, General Peleg Wadsworth's daughter Zilpha had married Stephen Longfellow. In 1807, their son Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, the poet, was born. He was not born here. He was born in a house on 4th Street. But very shortly thereafter, the general gave this property to his daughter and son-in-law. And this is where the poet grew up. Next, please. Next, please. Next, please.
Yeah, I think I did.
There you go. Okay. In 1815, the poet's father, Stephen, who was an attorney and a congressman, added a third story to the house. In 1814, there had been a roof fire in the house, and in dealing with putting the roof back on, so to speak, he decided to enlarge the house. He had a growing family, and also to update the style of the house. What we saw in that drawing of the house a moment ago was a very traditional gable-roofed, post-revolutionary style of architecture. And what Stephen Longfellow did in adding the third story to what is now the Wadsworth Longfellow House was to make it a larger federal-style house. We'll get into the federal style in just a moment. But he did retain the classical portico from the 18th century. Next, please.
There.
Here's a detail of the brickwork on the Wadsworth Longfellow House. It's classic 18th century brickwork. You can see the lovely sort of arched bricks that are perpendicular to the top of the window. And then there is a projecting string course of brick between the first and second stories. We actually know who the mason was who did the brickwork on the Wadsworth Longfellow House. His name was John Nichols, and he's also the mason who built the original portion of the Tower of Portland Headlight in 1790. The tradition says that the bricks were shipped in shipments from Philadelphia, and this is why it took 2 years for the initial house to be built. But brick making very quickly took hold in the Portland area in the late 18th and early 19th century, and entirely brick houses and buildings became very popular, as we'll see in a few moments. Next, please. Now we're on the interior of the Wadsworth Longfellow House, and the Maine Historical Society has owned the Wadsworth Longfellow House since 1901. Longfellow's parents died respectively in 1849 and 1851, and their daughter Anne Longfellow Pierce, who came back to take care of her parents after the death of her husband, really was the one who took over the house for the family after the parents' death. And Anne lived there for another 50 years. She is the great heroine of the saving of this house. She realized early on that her brother's national and international fame as a poet would make it a place of pilgrimage, really a literary shrine. And so she preserved the house and then left it to the Maine Historical Society. In recent years, the society has restored the interior of the house to show the different periods of occupation by the family. But the floor cloth and the wallpaper and the colors in the rooms, those are all from the period when Anne remodeled the house in 1851 after the death of her parents and how she lived there for the last 50 years of her life. The staircase is the original 1785-86 post-colonial staircase. Next, please. Here is the front parlor, the formal parlor of the house. And what this slide really reflects to us is that the Wadsworth Longfellow House is a classic New England home of several generations. It's a multi-generational accumulation of furnishings. After all, people did not live in specific periods. So we have at the left, we have an Empire pier table from the 1830s, an 1820s federal period mirror. Over the Victorian sofa is an 18th century Dutch painting. And then there's a circa 1800 print of Washington. I think you get the idea that it's a fairly eclectic mix of furnishings. Next, please. Here is the other major front room, which went through many transitions. It started as a dining room. It became a law office for the poet's father. And then in later years, it was Anne's informal parlor. Here we see at the left, a portrait of Anne, and next to it, a portrait done in the house in 1842 of the poet by the local portrait painter, Charles O. Cole. The beautiful piece of furniture in the alcove started as a dining room buffet, and then the bookcase was added to it, and it was converted into a desk by Stephen Longfellow. Next, please. Here is another view of that room, which shows us very simple, restrained federal period fireplace that would have been put in probably under Stephen when he was remodeling the house around 1815. Next, please. Now we turn to the kitchen, which has always been a favorite of visitors to the Wadsworth Longfellow House. When I first visited the house more years ago than I care to divulge, it was probably about five, this is the way the kitchen was presented, as it was when the house was first opened to the public in 1901, in which it was still almost a kind of Victorian aesthetic of more is better. You just brought out everything and hung it up and showed it as a sort of display. And then you didn't want any of these kitchen objects to get away, so you put a sort of a screen in front of them. I'm joking, of course. It was more to keep the tourists out. But this was the way the kitchen was displayed, you know, up until probably the 1960s or 70s. I had a wonderful professor at BU in graduate school named Abbott Cummings, who also was head of the Preservation Society. And he used to call displays like this the culinary obstacle course. Next, please. Next, please.
Working on it.
There.
This is the way the kitchen is presented today, and it's probably much more the way it was in Anne's time. There's still the great fireplace from the 18th century for cooking, but We know that Anne had a little cast iron cook stove. And of course, she didn't on any given day have all of her kitchen utensils out. Now we're on the second floor and we're in the parents' bedroom. And you may say, goodness, you know, what's going on with this wallpaper and with this bed hanging? These are authentic. This is what the taste was in 1851. In fact, probably the bed hanging is copper plate bedding hanging is a little bit earlier. But what we have to adjust ourselves to is that through the 19th century, there were many changing decorative tastes, and oftentimes the colors and the patterns are things that are maybe a little foreign to our 21st century eye. Next, please.
He wasn't one of the nine who voted, was he?
Who voted for? Who voted to object?
Did this come up?
We seem to be getting some static in the background.
Yeah.
Some talking in the background.
Yeah. I'm sorry, but would everybody please mute themselves? We're hearing some chatter in the background.
Yeah, we're getting somebody's radio or TV.
David, as host, you should be able to look at their name and mute them.
Yeah, I did that already, but somebody unmuted themselves, apparently.
Okay.
Sorry.
Seems to have stopped now.
Thank you. Very good. All right. So now we return to Stroudwater, and we now begin the transition from post-colonial into federal architecture. We're looking at the Jesse Partridge House in Stroudwater of 1786. It's a classic 18th century house, 2.5 stories, central chimney, kind of house of a prosperous middle or upper middle class family of the 18th century. This house, although it dates from after the Revolution, could easily have been built before the Revolution. But here we know who the architect builder was, which is rare for these 18th century houses in Maine. His name was John Kimball Sr. He had come from Newburyport during the Revolution, and he built this house for Jesse Partridge. Bear his name in mind because he will reappear very soon in doing buildings on the peninsula in Portland. Next, please. Here on the peninsula, on the western section of the peninsula, is the William Vaughan House on Danforth Street of 1799. Again, very traditional in form, although a little bit of variation in that it has double chimneys so that it allows for a little more ample stair hall. Essentially 18th century in form, but take a look at the doorway. Now we're beginning to have a kind of a simpler doorway in a sense from the more formal Georgian. And there is an arch over the doorway with lancet windows, broken triangular pediment. Now we're beginning to see the first evidence of what we will call the federal style, which in England was developing in the 1760s and 70s and came over here after the Revolution, called in England the Adamesque. For the Adam brothers who developed it, but for us, it's the federal style because it's our early federal period of government. Next, please. Here we have the Daniel Howe House on Danforth Street of 1799. The Daniel Howe House is one of the first houses in Portland to evoke the federal style. Note how tight the lines are, how crisp and tight the lines are of this house. It's entirely brick, and there's a very simple classical doorway, again, with an arched fanlight. On the interior, and I wish I had slides to share with you tonight, there's some very early 1790s, very delicate, very detailed federal period woodwork. Next, please. And then we come to the year 1800, and a great change in Portland architecture takes place. In the years after the Revolution, the 15 or so years after the Revolution, Portland was steadily growing on the peninsula, both in size and population, but also in terms of wealth and prosperity. This was a period after the Revolution when there was a lot of maritime trade, and merchants, shipbuilders, sea captains, for the first time made some serious fortunes. And they turned these fortunes into great houses. In the western section, what was then the western section of the city, what we would call the High Street, Spring Street, State Street neighborhood of today, merchants and ship captains began to build great three-story houses. This three-story form that we see before us in the McClellan House, built by Hugh McClellan, who was a merchant, in 1800-1801, and designed by that same architect builder who'd been out in Stroudwater, John Kimball Sr., this is one of the first of the great houses. These houses, and there are several of them, we'll take two or three examples in a moment, would cost about $20,000 a piece, which sounds like a petty sum today, but I don't know what the translation into today's dollars is, but it would be considerable. And they're very elegant houses. They have fan doorways, three-part Palladian windows above, delicate porticos, and beautiful balustrades on the outside. Next, please. And on the inside, great feats of architectural skill. This is the entrance hall for the McClellan House of 1800-1801, with what we call a flying staircase, in which the staircase goes up to a landing, not quite to the second floor, turns, and then there are staircases on either side and a kind of mezzanine around the open hall or atrium that feeds in to the bedrooms. Of course, all of this is the builder's feat of creating a cantilevered system of construction from step to step in the staircase, but nonetheless, really a really quite remarkable visual feat. Next, please. And here we're in the hallway of the McClellan House, looking through one of these elegantly inframed doorway enframements into the dining room. And look at the very decorative and colorful wallpaper. That is actually a period paper that we know was used in Portland in the early 1800s. Next, please. Here is another of these great houses. This is the Richard Hunnewell House on State Street. We know it today as the Portland Club. It was built in 1805, designed by another important architect builder of Federal Portland, a young man who came from Massachusetts in 1801 named Alexander Paris. He was here only through the War of 1812 and went on to be a major architect in Boston for the balance of his life. Next, please. Not everybody lived in a grand three-story mansion, and the John Dyer House on York Street of 1803 is a good example of a middle-class brick house of the early years of the 19th century. This is the little house that is right at the entrance to the Casco Bay Bridge, and it has again a doorway that's very similar to the Howe House that we saw a few minutes ago on Danforth Street. Next, please. Now, this prosperity that Portland was enjoying was relatively short-lived. In 1807, President Jefferson declared an embargo, closed the ports along the Atlantic coast, and there was an ensuing economic disaster because, of course, so much of the economy was depending on maritime trade. And the idea was that Jefferson did not want to have our American ships get caught in the crossfire of the Napoleonic Wars. But nonetheless, it created a serious economic hardship. And then that was only compounded by the War of 1812 that lasted into 1815. So after the War of 1812, we find a change. Federal period architecture is still in vogue, but now the houses are, for the most part, of a smaller scale. And a good hallmark of a late federal house from 1815 to maybe about 1830 is this recessed doorway with the louvered fan over it that we see in the John Howe House on Pleasant Street of 1817. Next, please. There were few people who managed to weather out the economic storm and after the war build three-story mansions. But even this one, the Thomas Robison House on Danforth and Park Streets, right across the street from Victoria Mansion, is smaller in its proportion, in its scale, than it would have been, say, in 1800 with Hugh McClellan building a house. Also, we see the louvered fan over the doorway, and now a characteristic of the late Federal, the stone lintels over the windows with the carved keystones that appear all across the front of this house. Next, please. We'll find very quickly that the 19th century in Portland, as well as elsewhere across America, is a constantly changing battle of styles. And an old style will fade out, a new style will come in, sometimes they overlap. A good example of overlapping is the Henry and Horace Ward houses on State Street of 1833. They are in part late Federal with their lovely arched doorways accented in carved granite and the recessed fan doorways with side lights. But there are classical elements that foreshadow the next style coming in that we call the Greek Revival. And they are the projecting brick pilasters across the front of the building. There are four of them, two on the corners and two in the center bay with Ionic capitals. And if you go inside the house, again, the woodwork is transitional. Another very important aspect of this house and of others now in the 1820s and 30s is the form that will become very prevalent in Portland in the 19th century, the double house. Someone will buy a plot of land within walking distance to the downtown, to the commercial area, to the waterfront, and they will maybe build their own house, and or maybe they'll build with a friend or a family member, or they will build their own house and then build a counterpart house to it and sell it for speculation. A lot of this went on beginning in the 1820s and 30s in Portland. Next, please. We speak of the Greek Revival, and of course, in its purest form, from the standpoint of Portland architecture, we're talking about Greek temples. And there are, on the peninsula, surviving today, only two major Greek temple-style houses, but there were several at one time. This is the first major example. It's right next to the McClellan House. It's part of the Portland Museum of Art complex today, and it's known as the Charles Q. Clapp House. Now, in true Grecian architecture, an Athenian, of ancient times, walking by this would not recognize it as a Greek temple or a Greek dwelling. It's an adaptation of Greek architecture, an adaptation of Greek elements. But nonetheless, it captures the spirit. Here's a big change. The facade is now the narrow end of the house. It is the triangular pediment, accentuates the sense of a temple form, as do the three columns on the indented walls on either side. Charles Q. Clapp was the son of the wealthiest man in Portland in the first half of the 19th century, Captain Asa Clapp, a great merchant and ship owner. And as such, Charles Q. Clapp spent most of his life from the 1820s until the 1860s as a real estate developer in Portland. If you go to the Cumberland County Registry today, you will find over 600 real estate transactions in his name over a 40-year period. This was his very stylish residence, which he designed himself. He was an amateur architect. He loved architecture, and he designed many of the buildings that he developed, including his own home, which has very distinctive interiors as well, as you can imagine. Next, please. The other full temple-style house in Portland is the Thomas O'Brien House on State Street of 1846-47. Here we have a more full Grecian columned colonnade on the front than we find on the Clapp Mansion, as well as some recessing. It gives a little more of a sense of a Greek temple in form. Next, please. Now, the Greek Revival was used at all levels of domestic architecture. Here we see a little cape-style house, a 1.5-story house built about 1839 in Stroudwater. It's a house built by the Partridge family, very modest dwelling, but it has important Greek Revival elements, including the recessed pilasters on the corners, the simple pilasters on either side of the doorway, the horizontal pediment over the doorway, and the little carved wreaths in the quarter windows above. I would just take a moment. I know in the past I've lectured on Shebig architecture, and I would just say that this little house is not unlike many, probably a dozen or more, of the wonderful 1840s, 50s Greek Revival capes that are in abundance on Shebig Island. Next, please. Here's another interesting form of the cape. This is the Ezra Russell double house on Mechanic Street off Cumberland Avenue, built in 1846. Russell was an architect builder in Portland in the 1840s and 50s, and he built one side of the house for himself and then sold the other half. Cape style, 1.5 stories, but with these very bold recessed pilasters across the front. The bay window would have been added at the right in the Victorian period. Next, please. Here's another example of the double Greek Revival form, now in a 2.5-story house. This is the Horace Richards house on Danforth Street of 1849-50. Again, like the Ezra Russell house, those bold pilasters marching across the front of the house. Next, please. And these double houses in the Greek Revival period of the 40s and the 50s were also built in brick. This is a good example on Maple Street, a house of about 1845. Very simple, very restrained. The sense of pilasters on the corners is achieved by these panels, these recessed panels of brickwork on the left and right. Next, please. Now, I've already mentioned with the Clapp House that there was a significant change evolving in the Greek Revival form for houses, in that even the more modest middle-class houses, many of them are perpendicular to the street. In other words, the gable end that formerly was on the side is now the facade of the house. And this is an example on Munjoy Hill of a house from the 1840s. Munjoy Hill developed very rapidly, parts of it, in the 1840s because of the coming of the Atlantic and St. Lawrence Railway and the Portland Company, where the engines and the rolling stock for the railway were built down at the foot of India Street. And so many of the workers, including Irish immigrants, began to build their homes on the slopes of Munjoy Hill. Next, please. Here's a close-up of the doorway of that house on Munjoy Hill with a very lovely Greek Revival style carving over the doorway. Carvings like this were copied from architect and builders' pattern books, guidebooks, such as those published in Boston by Asher Benjamin, a prominent architect. Next, please. Probably the largest 19th century housing development in Portland is the Park Street Row of 1835. It extends on the west side of Park Street from Spring Street down to Gray Street. It was 14 units of houses on Park Street, three on Gray Street that no longer stand, and three more on Spring Street that are still with us, 20 houses in all. It's very much patterned on the great Boston rows of houses, such as you'd find on Beacon Hill or in the south end of Boston from this period. It was built by a proprietary, a group of investors, who then auctioned off the houses individually. Although it's very restrained in its style, it does have, as do oftentimes the Beacon Hill houses, lovely fences of cast iron work, as well as balconies on the second floor. Next, please. The idea of a row of houses, which is a very urban development, is very much a part of Portland in the development of 19th century architecture. We're looking here at a much smaller row than the Park Street Row, and there was never another building built like the Park Street Row of that scale, but many people built spin-offs from it with maybe three or four or five houses together. This is the Hamlin Row at Danforth and Brackett Streets, built about 1835. Very restrained again, like the Park Street Row, but with Greek Revival doorways. Next, please. One of the most interesting and unrealized of these housing projects of the 1830s in the Greek Revival style. Here we see the double house designed and built by John Neal, who was one of the most colorful figures of 19th century Portland. He was born in Portland in 1793. He left as a young man, came back in the 1820s, spent the rest of his life here, dying in 1876. Neal was a multifaceted individual. He was an attorney. He was an art critic. He was a lecturer for women's rights. He was an advocate for early gymnasiums. You name it, John Neal was involved in it. Among other things, he was an amateur architect like Charles Q. Clapp. These two beautiful houses, double house, he lived in one and sold the other. He projected a plan of building a row of eight such houses with granite fronts along State Street in 1835. But his project was eclipsed by the Park Street Row of the same year. And so he was only able to build two of them. I can only imagine what State Street would look like today if instead of two of these granite fronted houses, there were eight running along that side of the street. Next, please. All right, now we're going to shift into an entirely different style. This is the Gothic Revival, which develops in England in the late 18th and early 19th century and begins to come to America in the 18 teens, 20s, and 30s. By the 1840s, it is a popular alternative and is actually beginning to replace the Greek Revival style. This is the house on Outer Spring Street that is popularly known as the Gothic House. It was built in 1845 by J.J. Brown, who was a stockbroker, and originally it stood where the Holiday Inn does now on the Spring Street arterial. It was the one house in a wonderful row of 19th century homes to be saved and moved to the other end of Spring Street when the Holiday Inn was built in the early 1970s. The house is based upon a design that was published in a book called Cottage Residences by A.J. Downing, a New York architect who promoted the Gothic Revival. But we know the architect was a man named Henry Rowe, who was born in Ireland, trained in England, and came to Portland in the 1840s. And he did a number of these picturesque Gothic houses. Gothic for the pointed arch window above the doorway, with the arched molding, Gothic for the peaked gables with the carving on them known as barge boards, Gothic for the attempt to make the exterior in match boarding look like stone. All of these are elements that came together for these sort of picturesque and romantic houses. This is the exact opposite of classicism. This is architectural romanticism, going back to the English architecture of the medieval period. Next, please. the architecture of the Gothic Revival is carried onto the inside of the J.J. Brown House. If you enter in a narrow hallway and look immediately to the left, and the staircase goes up and then turns, and what we're seeing here is at the stair landing are these three little Gothic windows. The staircase is in frame by a Gothic arch. Next, please. Here's another of these Gothic cottages at the west end of the city. This is the William A. Goodwin House at Vaughan and Bowden Streets of 1859. And we're looking here at a little different approach. Instead of the matched boarding that creates the sense of stonework, another approach to sheathing these wooden Gothic cottages was to lay the boards vertically on the frame, and then cover the seams with projecting strips of board, narrow strips of board that created this sort of board and batten look to the house. It was another way to create picturesque architecture. Next, please. Here's another example out in the Woodford section of Portland. This is the Warren Sparrow House on Arlington Street or Forest Avenue of 1852. And again, we see the board and batten treatment for the exterior. Next, please. Now, as though it wasn't enough to keep Federal and Greek Revival and Gothic in place in our discussion tonight, we quickly move on to the next style, which is known as the Italianate style. At the same time of the 1840s that the Gothic Revival was becoming popular in America and in Portland, the Italianate style, based on both Renaissance and Baroque Italian houses, particularly the Italian villas, was coming in as well through England to America. This is the Andrew and Samuel Spring houses on Danforth Street. They're often called the twins or the brothers, but if you look closely, there are slight differences. They were both built in 1855, designed by the same architect, Charles A. Alexander. But if you look at the one on the left, over the central projecting bay is an arched pediment, and the one on the right has a triangular pediment. So there are slight differences. These were built by Andrew and Samuel Spring, who were merchants, and their relationship was not brothers or father and son, but uncle and nephew. Next, please. The premier example of the Italianate style, not only for Portland, but probably for all of America prior to the Civil War, is the Ruggles Sylvester Morse House, or the Morse Libby House, or the Victoria Mansion at Danforth and Park Streets, built between 1858 and 1860, designed by Henry Austin, a leading architect of the period from New Haven, Connecticut. The Victoria Mansion is Italianate for its asymmetry. At the right, you see the big projecting bay with the triangular pediment. More or less in the center, although it's a little off center, is the tower with its Italianate arches and the very strong overhang with the brackets that you also see on the roof line. And then it recesses back a little bit for the two bays with the porch. Again, this is purposeful. This is to create a sort of an asymmetrical, romantic sense to the architecture. But at the same time, it's much more formal than the Gothic Revival because it's basically using the precepts of classicism as it was used in Italy in the Renaissance and the Baroque period. The front of the house and the principal side on Park Street are actually completely sheathed in Connecticut brownstone, Portland, Connecticut brownstone. And then on the right-hand side in the back, it's brickwork that has a sort of mastic cement, a plasterwork over it that's scored to make it look like stonework. Next, please. Now, the house may seem a bit formal and forbidding on the inside, on the outside, but just go on the inside, and we'll very quickly go through a series of interior views. It's really a riot of color and decoration. It's one of the great American interiors of the Victorian period. The wall paintings, the paintings on the ceilings, the elaborate carpet on the floor, the beautiful woodwork. This is the great entrance hall. Note that there's a flying staircase, not unlike the one in the McClellan house of 60 years before, getting to a landing, breaking, and then creating a mezzanine for reaching the bedrooms. Next, please. Here we have what is variously known as the reception room or the music room. It's immediately to the right. It's a very elaborate Italian carved marble mantelpiece. Everywhere throughout this house, the walls and the ceilings are painted with elaborate paintings in the trompe d'oeil style, done by a group of Italian painters who were working out of New York in the period. The portrait to the left is of the man who built the house, Ruggles Sylvester Morse, who had humble beginnings in Leeds, Maine, near Lewiston, made a fortune in the hotel business in New Orleans before the Civil War, and came back to build this house as a summer house in 1858 to 1860. Next, please. This is another view of the music room or the reception room, and I think you can see the extraordinary panels of wall paintings on the walls of this room. Very elaborate gas fixture coming down from the ceiling. Next, please. And this is an older photograph, a black and white photograph of the principal parlor, again with similar elaborate decoration, including the carved marble mantelpiece, the very elaborate wall paintings, and the great gasolier in the center. Next, please. And here's the dining room, which is, I think, a good example of this trompe l'oeil or trick of the art painting. The walls of the dining room are true wood paneling. But if you look at the ceiling, it continues the wood theme. It looks like it's very elaborate inlay in wood. The entire ceiling is trompe l'oeil paint. It's a painting made to look like wood. Next, please. And here we have the library. In these Victorian houses, there began to be rooms that were decorated in historical themes. And the next two bring this out very nicely. This is the library. There are Gothic arches and other Gothic features on the ceiling and so on, Gothic arches over the bookcases. The idea of medieval learning was the theme for your library. Next, please. And after dinner, and we know this from Downton Abbey, where the gentlemen retire for smoking their cigars or their pipes, we find the Egyptian smoking room. Imagine that, not Egyptian, I'm sorry, get in trouble with the Egyptians, the Turkish smoking room, forgive me. And this is right in the second level of the tower. Very elaborate arabesque designs painted on the walls and the ceilings. And this was the gentleman's retiring room. Next, please. Now, the Italian villa style was very popular in Portland as elsewhere. And we find in this more modest example, the Merrill House at the corner of Spring Street, 1858. This is by George M. Harding, who was a local architect in Portland in the 1850s to the 1870s. It has many of the features of Victoria Mansion, only on a much more reduced scale and in wood, including the Italianate tower, the overhang of the roof with brackets, and some of the classical treatment of the windows. Next, please. Here's another variation on the Italianate style. This is the William Safford House at High Street and Spring Street, built in 1858, probably designed by Charles Alexander, who did those two houses on Danforth Street. A very handsome house with slightly curved semicircular bay windows in the style that was being adopted in Boston in the 1840s and 50s for houses. A very strong statement here of the Italianate, Palladian windows, three-part windows with arches in the first story outlined in brownstone, modified Palladian windows on the second and third story as well. Principally built of brick, but with brownstone trim. This is now the headquarters of Greater Portland Landmarks. Next, please. And here's another house using the bowed front that one would have found in Boston in the 1840s and 50s. This is the Charles and Luther Frost double house just off Longfellow Square and State Street, built about 1860. And the wooden porch on the second floor that kind of joins the two sides of the house together is in the Venetian Italian style. So for a moment along State Street, you're on the Grand Canal. Next, please. Here we see Portland in 1855 from what was then Cape Elizabeth with the Dyer Shipyard in the foreground. In 1855, Portland was at the zenith of its prosperity, of its height, of its power as a New England city. It had expanded from the post-revolutionary period of 2,000 people. When statehood came in 1820, Portland had about 8,000 in population. And from 1820 to 1855, about a 35-year period, we find Portland, pardon me, that would be, got to do my math here. Let's see, 20, 30, yeah, for 35-year period. We find that the population had risen to 30,000. Now, to some degree, this was due to significant Irish immigration into Portland in the 1840s and 50s. Just to get our bearings, on the right is Mountjoy Hill. The tower that's coming up from center left of Mountjoy Hill is the Portland Observatory. Then we have the highly densely built center of the peninsula. And then to the left, we have the Western Promenade area, which was still to a large degree undeveloped. Keep this image in mind because, of course, 11 years later, the whole center of the city is destroyed in the Great Fire. But this was not in people's sights in 1855 when this print was made to celebrate the prosperity of the city. Next, please. Now we jump to the fire very quickly. So this is a map from 1866. It was originally printed as a fold-out map for the Portland Directory of that year. There was no premonition that it would be quickly reprinted with this red overlay on it showing the path of the Great Fire. I won't get into the Great Fire too much, so I'm going to show a few images now because I will deal with that in our third lecture in March. But just to suffice to say, it began near the foot of High and Commercial Streets. That would be the lower part of the red area that you see in the fire, right on Commercial Street in the waterfront. It started in a boat shop, very modestly. People didn't take it too seriously. They thought they'd put it out. And then it moved on very quickly to Brown's Sugar House, which exploded, this great eight-story factory. And then the wind was right. The tide was out. And of course, the fire department, there was no central water system in Portland. The only water was either from the cells, from the wells and cisterns that were on the peninsula, most of them in private properties, And then they did, when there were fires near the waterfront, they would draw water from the harbor, but the tide was out when the fire started. So the winds were right. They whipped the fire across the peninsula, and it really didn't burn itself out till it was on the slopes of Munjoy Hill at North Street the next morning. Next, please. This is a primitive painting, a wonderful folk art painting that really captures the horror of being in the middle of the fire and trying to escape from it. This is the old Second Parish Church on Middle Street that obviously burned in the fire. And we see people with their belongings trying to escape the path of the fire, people with wagons, with coaches, people just carrying whatever they could. Next, please. And these are the ruins. A few days afterwards, this is a print taken from the juncture of Free and Middle Streets, looking east down Middle Street, and way up in the background, behind the smoke, is Munjoy Hill, and you can just see the little tower of the observatory. The Great Fire was the most devastating urban fire in America up to its time. It really gutted the center third of the peninsula. It left 10,000 people homeless out of that population of 30,000. And it caused about $12 million worth of damage. Sadly, it was quickly eclipsed by the Chicago Fire of 1871 and the Boston Fire of 1872. So our dubious distinction of being the worst urban fire in American history, for better or for worse, it did not last long. Next, please. Here's a modern day photograph of the observatory, a really unique structure, built in 1807 at the height of Munjoy Hill, 82 feet high. It was the concept of Captain Lemuel Moody, a mariner, who built it as a signal tower in the prosperous federal period when the ships were coming in. Each ship owner, merchant, had his own flag. He would fly his flag on his vessel. There was a telescope at the top of the observatory. The flag would be spotted, and then the merchant's flag would go up on the observatory, and the people who owned his or ran his wharf would get the wharf ready for the ship coming in. There are many other aspects to the observatory, but this was one of the principal functions. But in the time of the fire, the observatory was one of the few structures at the top of Munjoy Hill, and there was still a large area of undeveloped land from Munjoy Hill down to Washington Avenue. Next, please. And indeed, the reason I show you the observatory at this juncture is to show you photos that were taken from the observatory that show you the devastation. We're looking, Congress Street is just to the left, Cumberland Avenue is in the center. We're looking toward Back Cove. The big building at the right is the old Cumberland County Jail of 1858 on Monroe Street that was torn down back in the 1960s. And this is where the fire ended. It burned its way up Cumberland Avenue to North Street and then ended there. Next, please. And here's another view from the observatory looking down on the city. This was the open land that the city owned. And of course, this was like a fire break. The fire didn't come up this part of the slopes of Munjoy Hill. In the background is the Eastern Cemetery, where a lot of people fled because it was an open area. And then in a short time after the fire, the U.S. Army sent Civil War surplus tents, about 1,500 of them, to be pitched in this area of open land, of common land owned by the city, as a tent city for people, almost like a refugee camp. Next, please. Here's a view. It's a print, but it's based on a photograph taken from the observatory. At the center is Congress Street. At the right is a little Italianate brick house that's still standing today that the fire did not get to. And then the whole city, the sweep of the city below, the center of the city is all in ruins. And there's the tent city on the left. Next, please. This is the same scene 20 years later. And within 10 years, the peninsula was almost completely rebuilt and greatly expanded to the east, to Munjoy Hill, and to the west, to the Western Promenade. It was an extraordinary rebuilding period. Next, please. And the whole new neighborhoods opened up on Munjoy Hill and in the western part of the city. One of the very prominent neighborhoods was the Deering Street area that extends from High Street over to Mellon Street. This is a view about 1870 of some of the beautiful new Victorian houses that were built along Deering Street immediately after the fire. Portland adopted very strict building ordinances and allowed only commercial buildings, most of them of brick, to be built in the center of the city. So people shifted and created new neighborhoods where they had once lived in the center of the city. They now lived in the east and western sections. Next, please. Here is one of the wonderful houses built on Deering Street right after the fire. This is the George M. Harding House. He was an architect very much involved in the design of buildings after the Great Fire, and apparently did very well by his practice, because this is the house he built in 1868. And he's standing there in his silk hat, leaning on the fence. His wife is in the window at the right, and his children are peeking out the second floor windows. Next, please. Here we're looking from State Street back toward High Street along Deering Street as the street begins to be built out in the late 1860s and the early 1870s. Next, please. Now, in the post-fire period, there was a lot of Italian architecture, Italianate style that was still used, but a new style had been introduced just before the fire that became very popular in the 1860s and 70s, called the French Second Empire or Mansard style. And this is the distinctive roof that we see on the Francis Fessenden House of 1868. Oops. Oh my God, what have I done? Jesus. Oh my God. Yes, we're back in business. I'm sorry. This is not a perfect technology, this Zoom technology. So here we have the Francis Fessenden House at the corner of Mellon and Deering Streets, with this distinctive new roof form that actually creates a third story for houses and buildings, with a slight angle and the dormers. So when you see this configuration, it's usually 1860s and 70s. Next, please. And here we find the mansard style also used on this four-unit row house on the corner of State and Deering Streets. This was a building project developed by an architect builder named Simon Libby, built in 1868. Next, please. Now, the development of the Western Promenade begins before the fire with the man who really takes Captain Asa Clapp's position as the wealthiest man in Portland. Clapp dies in the late 1840s, and John Bundy Brown becomes the great man of wealth and business from about 1850 until his death in 1881. Among Brown's many enterprises is the development of the western section of the city from about 1850 until the late 19th century. And what we see here is Brown buying the Western Promenade, the whole 400 acres of what is the Western Promenade neighborhood in 1850, and carving out what he viewed as the 10 best acres on the Western Promenade itself, creating a great personal estate called Bram Hall, designed by Charles Alexander, in the Italian villa style, with this massive lawn, these beautiful drives and landscape, and then beginning to lay out streets and subdivide the land on the rest of the Western Promenade neighborhood to sell. Not many people bought before the Great Fire, but after the fire, many people moved to the western section of the city. Brown did very well in developing the Western Promenade, and as though it were not enough to own most of the Western Promenade neighborhood, he also had his own bank, where if you bought land from him, you could be financed by his bank as well. Next, please. Here's one of his housing developments from the post-fire period, built in 1866. This is known as the Pine Street Row. It was designed by Charles Alexander in the Italianate style, and it contains eight housing units along Pine Street. This is one of several Brown-built double houses or row houses. Next, please. Other companies built row houses for the development of the Western Promenade neighborhood. This is, let me just get this correctly here. This is the Portland Tenement House Company row on Pine Street, built in 1870. You can see it uses the mansard style. There are four units here. The connotation of the word tenement was a little different in 1870 than it was in the early 1900s, when tenement houses were multi-story houses for people who were of more modest income. Here we see these very fashionable houses being built by a development company and then sold individually. Next, please. And this is another example of the work of the Portland Tenement House Company on Carlton Street in the western section of the city, also built in 1870. Now, instead of a mansard roof, it has an Italianate overhang. Next, please. Whole rows of these mansard houses in wood, middle-class houses, were built in the new Western Promenade neighborhood. These are a whole row of such houses from around 1870 on Cushman Street. Next, please. One of the grandest houses to be built in the Western Promenade neighborhood is the home of the architect Francis H. Fassett, a double house in the high Victorian Gothic style, built in 1876 on Pine Street for Fassett and his son, who was also his architectural partner. Next, please. So here we have the bird's eye view of Portland in 1878. 10 years after the Great Fire wiped out the center of the peninsula, much of the peninsula is rebuilt and whole new neighborhoods have opened up to the right on Munjoy Hill and to the left in the Western Promenade area. And Portland, true to its motto of resurgam, rose again. Next, please. This is a photograph taken roughly from the location of the old Main General Hospital on Bramhall Street, looking down across the peninsula towards State Street. And here, within a relatively short 10 years, whole new neighborhoods have been built in the wake of the Great Fire. Victorian houses of the 1860s and 70s in the foreground. Next, please. The peninsula ultimately becomes developed on the eastern and western portions by around 1900. And it is at this point that Portland feels it needs to expand. And much like Boston would annex places like Brighton and other areas that were towns or cities, so Portland annexed the Deering area, which was a city by that time, in order to expand its territory for residential development. And thus we see the development of the peninsula from the time of the revolution, right afterwards with General Wadsworth's house, right on up to 1900. Thank you very much. Oh, one more. This is just a fun ending. This is a photograph of what was once a very fine Greek Revival house on Cumberland Avenue. By the time that the late photographer Mason Philip Smith took this photograph, it had lost one of its columns, although the Capitol was still holding on, propped up by a stick at the left. And this once wonderful old Greek Revival house had been turned into the laundromat. You drop them off and you pick them up. Now and later, 30-minute service. And of course, this was all swept away in the 60s for a parking lot. Thus endeth our talk.
All right. Thank you so much. I do want to note that I think we had around 25 computers tuned in, which probably translates to 30 or 40 people. So we did pretty well. And we'll now open the floor up to questions for Earl. I think everybody can just kind of mute. I think I can see everybody. So just unmute yourself and raise your hand, and I'll recognize you, and you can chat with Earl. Okay, Lynn, I see you first.
Great. Earl, in that 1878 map of Portland, I found it curious that there were some what appeared to be small ships in the back cove.
Yes.
I don't think of the back cove as being necessarily shipworthy. So I'm just wondering, was that just fanciful? Or?
No. Actually, you raise a very good question. And that is that there was a dredged channel in the back cove in the 19th century. A little bit about the back cove. You know, we saw the earlier maps of the peninsula where the land in the center of the peninsula was quite narrow, 4th Street to Oxford Street, just below Cumberland Avenue. And then Charles Q. Clapp, the man who did the Greek Temple House next to the McCollin House, now owned by the museum, he was really a remarkable developer and entrepreneur. And in the 1840s and 50s, he envisioned the idea, and this was the pressure that was already building by immigration and the growth of the city. He envisioned filling in land from Oxford Street down to what we call today Marginal Way, which is parallel to 95, the interstate that goes through Portland. Mm-hmm. And so over a period of years, he had to go to the legislature and get authorization to actually, you know, change the tidal coast, so to speak. But he did. And he filled it in. There's a great escarpment, you don't see it today, but above Washington Avenue, he dug earth out of the land above Washington Avenue. He created a horse railway down to the shore of Back Cove, and filled in Back Cove and made new streets to develop it. So, but at the same time, he also developed a little railroad station there. There was a small railroad that came in there. And there were also industries there, including a very important industry, which is why you see the ships. At the about where Hannaford's is now, was a big pottery, the Winslow Pottery. And that's why, and they made, you know, primarily, they made industrial pottery. They made tubing for water systems, and they made drains for houses and chimney pieces and all kinds of things. But that industry lasted from the mid 19th century into the 1920s and 30s, and they had to have a ship channel there And there were other smaller industries there as well. But a great question, really.
That explains it. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, and I should add also that it wasn't a derogatory term in those days, but popularly, people in the 1850s and 60s called the new made land that Clapp was making, they called it Clapp's dump, because of course he was dumping earth into the back cove, and so they called it Clapp's dump. So
anyone else? Donna.
Yeah, I had a question about Back Cove. I actually have some correspondence where they were making the plan to actually dredge the channel, because my husband's a descendant of Moses Gould, who was also one of those people who was developing. They had Gould's Wharf at the end of Franklin Street. But I had heard that they took a lot of the rubble from the fire and dumped it in down there. Is that true?
I think that might have happened to some degree, Donna. But the initial development there of the streets that extended from Oxford Street to Marginal Way, a lot of that was done prior to the fire. And it shows up on the maps that are in the city directories from about 1852 to about 1866. But I don't doubt that some of the rubble from the fire, although there also are accounts that there was a lot of salvage of brick after the fire, that young boys and young men were hired by the dozens to, you know, go into the rubbled areas and clean off the bricks and stack them up and try to recycle them as well. But there would have been a lot of rubble as well. So
thank you.
So I see that quite a few people have their videos turned off, and that's fine. But if you raise your hand, I won't be able to see you. But I see Linda.
You may have said this during your last lecture, but given my memory cells, when did Falmouth become Portland? And was Falmouth the current Falmouth?
Yeah. Oh, let me explain that. There's something in the history of Portland called ancient Falmouth, which, you know, was a very large land area in the 17th century. Mm-hmm. And then you have the next stage is that Falmouth more closely defines itself about 1718, after the initial French and Indian Wars. And that includes the peninsula, and it also includes places like Deering and Westbrook and Stroudwater and so on. Then after the Revolution in 1786, Portland gets incorporated as a separate town. It breaks off from the rest of Falmouth. And then there are a number of, I won't go into all of it, but there are a number of machinations that take place with the founding of Westbrook, the founding of present day Falmouth, and so on. And in the midst of all of that, I referenced Deering. Deering declares itself a town in 1871. It breaks away from Westbrook. And then it calls itself a city in 1892, and then it gets annexed, taken over by Portland in 1899. But back to your initial question, it starts about 1718 with a place called Falmouth as a town, and then Portland as a peninsula and as a corporate civic entity begins in 1786.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right. Anyone else? Again, if you're okay, Jane, you have to unmute yourself. There you go.
In the picture that was, you said it was taken from Main General or that area up after.
Yes.
Later on.
Right.
It appears that there's a reservoir. Is that
yes. What
it could be?
Yes, you're absolutely right. One of the things that was established after the fire were reservoirs for the east and west end of the city. Mm-hmm. That reservoir is where there is a parking lot for Maine Medical Center now.
Oh, okay.
You've probably gone by it or maybe even used it. It's fairly close to the main entrance of Maine Medical Center.
Okay.
And I can remember in my youth growing up in Portland, the reservoir was still there, and then it was discontinued by the Portland Water District, and the hospital acquired it and tore down the reservoir and created a parking lot.
Interesting. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, anyone else who may be if you're muted and with your video turned off, just speak up if you'd like to ask a question. Excuse me. Well, I think that's it then, unless Donna's got her hand up.
I just wanted to thank Earl. Earl sent the Historical Society a copy of his new book, which is fabulous. David and I were looking at it the other day. Want to give yourself a little pitch, Earl?
Well, just very briefly, as state historian, I gave a lot of thought to what might be one or more good projects for the bicentennial. As you remember, we tried to have a bicentennial last year, but a few things intervened. Maybe we'll have one later this year. In any case, one of the projects that I thought about for a long time was the fact that prior to the Civil War, from about 1830 to the Civil War, there were these beautiful big panoramic lithographs, prints made of Maine towns and cities. In fact, the one that I showed tonight of Portland in 1855 is a very good example of that, and it's in the project. So they had never been brought together in one place. And so I talked to several museums, and the museum that was so receptive and so supportive of the project was the Bowdoin College Museum of Art. And they said, oh yes, we'd love to do this as a bicentennial exhibit. So I brought I found copies of all of the original prints. There were something like about 20 of them. And then we decided to add to the exhibit by having a whole gallery devoted to all the early prints of Bowdoin College. The first print was printed about 1825 or 30. And there were views of Bowdoin made frequently every few years, so we could see the chronological development of the campus from the 1820s to the early 1900s. So we put that exhibit together, and it opened in mid-December and was going to run through the Bowdoin commencement so that the Bowdoin alumni could see the pictures of the college. And then, of course, the pandemic came and the museum closed in March. But fortunately, two permanent records of the exhibit exist. One is very easy for everybody to access. You go to the Bowdoin College Museum of Art website and you find online exhibitions and go to Maine's Lithographic Landscapes, and you'll get all of the pictures, both of the towns and of Bowdoin that were in the exhibit, all of the text, all of the information. And I think there may be a couple videos of me talking about it as well. And then we were so fortunate, we received a grant to publish the exhibit in the form of a catalog, in the form of a book. And that's what Donna is referencing. And I wanted the Chabig Historical Society to have a copy of that for your library. And I appreciate your mentioning it, Donna.
Well, thank you very much. It's wonderful.
All right, then. Anybody else? I'm looking for raised hands and not. So I'm going to thank Earl very much for yet another very instructive and enjoyable presentation. And yeah, we can all do this. Right. And tune in for our next historical series in a couple of weeks. And again, great thanks to Earl, and we'll be seeing him again in March, I believe. And in the meantime, everybody, stay safe, and let's hope we still have a republic.
Yeah, right. if we can keep it.
Yes, that's what I was thinking about.
Thank you.
Good night,
Goodbye.
All.
Goodbye.
Good night. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Good night.